Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 10 of Three Men in a Boat.
I was very cold when I got back into the boat, and in my hurry to get my shirt on, I accidentally jerked it into the water. It made me awfully wild, especially as George burst out laughing. I could not see anything to laugh at, and I told George so, and he only laughed the more. I never saw a man laugh so much. I quite lost my temper with him at last, and I pointed out to him what a driveling maniac of an imbecile idiot he was, but he only roared the louder. And then, just as I was landing the shirt, I noticed that it was not my shirt at all, but George's, which I had mistaken for mine. Whereupon the humor of the thing struck me for the first time, and I began to laugh. And the more I looked from George's wet shirt to George, roaring with laughter, the more I was amused, and I laughed so much that I had to let the shirt fall back into the water again. "Aren't you going to get it out?" said George, between his shrieks. I could not answer him at all for a while, I was laughing so, but at last, between my peals, I managed to jerk it out. "It isn't my shirt, it's yours." I never saw a man's face change from lively to severe so suddenly in my life before. "What?" he yelled, springing up. "You silly cuckoo! Why can't you be more careful what you're doing? Why the deuce don't you go and dress on the bank? You're not fit to be in a boat, you're not. Give me the hitcher." I tried to make him see the fun of thing, but he could not. George is very dense at seeing a joke sometimes. Harris proposed that we should have scrambled eggs for breakfast. He said he would cook them. It seemed from his account that he was very good at doing scrambled eggs. He often did them at picnics and when out on yachts. He was quite famous for them. People who had once tasted his scrambled eggs, so we gathered from his conversation, never cared for any other food afterwards, but pined away and died when they could not get them. It made our mouths water to hear him talk about the things, and we handed him out the stove and the frying pan and all the eggs that had not been smashed, and gone over everything in the hamper, and begged him to begin. He had some trouble in breaking the eggs, or rather, not so much trouble in breaking them exactly as in getting them into the fry pan when broken, and keeping them off his trousers and preventing them from running up his sleeve. But he fixed some half dozen into the pan, and at last, squatting down by the side of the stove, he chivied them about with a fork. It seemed harassing work, so far as George and I could judge. Whenever he went near the pan, he burnt himself, and then he would drop everything and dance around the stove, flicking his fingers about and cursing the things. Indeed, every time George and I looked round at him, he was sure to be performing this feat. We thought at first that it was a necessary part of the culinary arrangements. We did not know what scrambled eggs were, and we fancied that it must be some Red Indian or Sandwich Island sort of dish that required dances and incantations for its proper cooking. Montmorency went and put his nose over it once, and the fat sputtered up and scalded him, and then he began dancing and cursing. Altogether, it was one of the most interesting and exciting operations I've ever witnessed. George and I were both quite sorry when it was over. The result was not altogether the success that Harris had anticipated. There seemed so little to show for the business. 6 eggs had gone into the frying pan, and all that came out was a teaspoonful of burnt and unappetizing-looking mess. Harris said it was the fault of the frying pan, and thought it would have gone better if we had had a fish kettle and a gas stove. Then we decided not to attempt the dish again until we had those aids to housekeeping by us. The sun had got more powerful by the time we had finished breakfast, and the wind had dropped, and it was a lovely morning as one could desire. Little was in sight to remind us of the 19th century, and as we looked out upon the river in the morning sunlight, we could almost fancy that the centuries between us and that ever-to-be-famous June morning of 1215 had been drawn aside, and that we, English yeoman's sons in homespun cloth, with a dirk at belt, were waiting there to witness the writing of that stupendous page of history, the meaning whereof was to be translated to the common people some 400 and odd years later by one Oliver Cromwell, who had deeply studied it. It was a fine summer morning, sunny, soft, still, but through the air there runs a thrill of coming stir. King John has slept at Duncroft Hall, and all day before the little town of Staines has echoed to the clang of armed men and the clatter of great horses over its rough stones, and the shouts of captains and the grim oaths and surly jests of bearded bowmen, billmen, pikemen, and strange-speaking foreign spearmen. Brightly colored cloak companies of knights and squires have ridden in, all travel-stained and dusty, and all the evening long the timid townsmen's doors have had to be quickly opened to let in rough groups of soldiers, for whom there must be found both board and lodging, and the best of both, or woe betide the house and all within. For the sword is judge and jury, plaintiff and executioner, in these tempestuous times, and pays for what it takes by sparing those from whom it takes it, if it pleases to do so. Round the campfire in the marketplace gather still more of the baron's troops, and eat and drink deep, and bellow forth roistering drinking songs, and gamble and quarrel as the evening grows and deepens into night. The firelight sheds quaint shadows on their piled-up arms, on their uncouth forms. The children of the town steal round to watch them, wondering, and brawny country wenches, laughing, draw near to the bandy alehouse jest, and jibe with the swaggering troopers, so unlike the village swains, who, now despised, stand apart behind with vacant grins upon their broad, peering faces. And out from the fields around glitter the faint lights of more distant camps, as here some great lord's followers lie mustered, and there false John's French mercenaries hover like crouching wolves without the town. And so, with sentinel in each dark street, and twinkling watchfires on each height around, the night has worn away, and over this fair valley of Old Tame has broken the morning of the great day that is to close so big with the fate of ages yet unborn. Ever since gray dawn in the lower of the two islands, just above where we are standing, there has been great clamor and the sound of many workmen. The great pavilion brought here yester-eve is being raised, and the carpenters are busy nailing tiers of seats, while prentices from London town are there with many colored stuffs and silks and cloth of gold and silver. And now, lo, down upon the road that winds along the river's bank from Staines, there comes towards us, laughing and talking together in deep guttural bass, a half score of the stalwart halbert men, baron's men. These and halt at 100 yards or so above us on the other bank, and lean upon their arms and wait. And so from hour to hour march up along the road ever fresh groups and bands of armed men, their casque and breastplates flashing back the long, low lines of morning sunlight, until as far as the eye can reach, the way seems thick with glittering steel and prancing steeds, and shouting horsemen are galloping from group to group, and little banners are fluttering lazily in the warm breeze, and every now and then there is a deeper stir, as the ranks make way on either side, and some great baron on his great war horse, with his guard of squires round him, passes along to take his station at the head of his serfs and vassals. And up the slope of Cooper's Hill, just opposite, are gathered the wondering rustics and curious townfolks who have run from Staines, and none are quite sure what the bustle is about, but each one has a different version of the great event that they have come to see. And some say that much good to all the people will come from this day's work, but the old men shake their heads, for they have heard such tales before. And all the river down to Staines is dotted with small craft and boats and tiny coracles which last are growing out of favor now and are used only by the poorer folk. Over the rapids where in after years trim Belware Lock will stand, they have been forced or dragged by their sturdy rowers and are now crowded up as near as they dare come to the great covered barges which lie in readiness to bear King John to where the fateful charter awaits his signing. It is noon, and we and all the people have been waiting patiently for many an hour, and the rumor has run round that Slippery John has escaped from the baron's grasp and has stolen away from Duncroft Hall with his mercenaries at his heels, and will soon be doing other work than signing charters for his people's liberty. Not so. This time the grip upon him has been one of iron, and he has slid and wriggled in vain. Far down the road a little cloud of dust has risen, and draws nearer and grows larger, and the pattering of many hooves grows louder, and in and out between the scattered groups of drawn-up men there pushes on its way a brilliant cavalcade of brightly dressed lords and knights, and up front, in rear, and either flank, there ride the yeomen of the barons, and in the midst, King John. He rides to where the barges lie in readiness, and the great barons step forth from their ranks to meet him. He greets them with a smile and laugh, and pleasant honeyed words, as though it were some feast in his honor to which he had been invited. But as he rises to dismount, he casts one hurried glance from his own French mercenaries, drawn up in the rear to the grim ranks of the baron's men that hem him in. Is it too late? One fierce blow at the unsuspecting horseman at his side, one cry to his French troops, one desperate charge upon the unready lines before him, and these rebellious barons might rue the day they dared to thwart his plans. A bolder hand might have turned the game even at that point. Had it been a Richard there, the cup of liberty might have been dashed from England's lips, and the taste of freedom held back for hundreds of years. But the heart of King John sinks before the stern faces of the English fighting men, and the arm of King John drops back on to his rein, and he dismounts and takes his seat in the foremost barge, and the barons follow in with each mailed hand upon the sword hilt, and the word is given to let go. Slowly the heavy, bright-decked barges leave the shore of Running Mead. Slowly against the swift current they work their ponderous way, till, with a low grumble, they grate against the bank of the little island that from this day will bear the name Magna Carta Island. And King John has stepped upon the shore, and we wait in breathless silence till a great shout cleaves the air, and the great cornerstone in England's Temple of Liberty has, now we know, been firmly laid. Chapter 12. I was sitting on the bank, conjuring up this scene to myself, when George remarked that, when I was quite rested, perhaps I would not mind helping to wash up, and thus recalled from the days of the glorious past to the prosaic present, with all its misery and sin, I slid down into the boat, and cleaned out the frying pan with a stick of wood and a tuft of grass, polishing it up finely with George's wet shirt. We went over to Magna Carta Island, and had a look at the stone which stands in the cottage there, and on which the Great Charter is said to have been signed, though as to whether it really was signed there, or as some say, on the other bank at Running Mead, I decline to commit myself. As far as my own personal opinion goes, however, I am inclined to give weight to the popular island theory. Certainly, had I been one of the barons at that time, I should have strongly urged upon my comrades the advisability of our getting such a slippery customer as King John onto the island, where there was less chance of surprises and tricks. There are the ruins of an old priory in the grounds of Ankerwyke House, which is close to Picnic Point, and it was round about the grounds of this old priory that Henry VIII is said to have waited for and met Anne Boleyn. He also used to meet her at Hever Castle in Kent, and also somewhere near St. Albans. I must have been difficult for the people of England in those days to have found a spot where these thoughtless young folks were not found. Have you ever been in a house where there are many couples? It is most trying. You think you will go and sit in the drawing room, and you march off there. As you open the door, you hear a noise as if somebody had suddenly recollected something, and, when you get in, Emily is over by the window, full of interest in the opposite side of the road, and your friend, John Edward, is at the other end of the room, with his whole soul held in thrall by the photographs of other people's relatives. Oh, you say, pausing at the door, I didn't know anyone was here. Oh, didn't you? Says Emily, coldly, in a tone which implies that she does not believe you. You hang about for a bit, then you say, why don't you light the gas? John Edward says, oh, he hadn't noticed it. And Emily says, Papa does not like the gas lit in the afternoon. You tell them one or two items of news, and give them your views and opinions on the Irish question, but this does not appear to interest them. All they remark on any subject is, oh, is it? Did he? Yes, and you don't say so. And after 10 minutes of such style of conversation, you edge up to the door and slip out, and are surprised to find that the door immediately closes behind you and shuts itself without your ever having touched it. Half an hour later, you think you will try a pipe in the conservatory. The two chairs that are in place are occupied by Emily and John Edward, and you back out promptly and shut the door behind you. You are afraid to poke your nose into any room in the house now, so after walking up and down the stairs for a while, you go and sit in your own bedroom. This becomes uninteresting, however, after a time, and so you put on your hat and stroll out into the garden. You walk down the path, and as you pass the summer house, you glance in, and there are those two young idiots, and they see you and are evidently under the idea that for some wicked purpose of your own, you are following them about. You rush back to the hall and get your umbrella and go out. It must have been much like this when the foolish boy, Henry VIII, was courting his little Anne. People in Buckinghamshire would have come upon them unexpectedly round Windsor and Raybury, and have exclaimed, "Oh, here you are!" And Henry would have blushed and said, "Yes," had just come over to see a man, and Anne would have said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Isn't it funny? I've just met Mr. Henry VIII in the lane, and he's going the same way that I am." Then those people would have gone away and said to themselves, "Oh, we'd better get out of here. We'll go down to Kent." And they would go to Kent, and the first thing they would see in Kent when they got there would be Henry and Anne round Hever Castle. "Oh, drat this," they would have said. "Here, let's go away. I can't stand any more of this. Let's go down to St. Albans Place." "Quiet place, St. Albans." And when they reached St. Albans, there would be that wretched couple. Then these folks would go and be pirates until the marriage was over. From Picnic Point to Old Windsor Lock is a delightful bit of the river, a shady road, dotted here and there with dainty little cottages, runs by the bank up to the Bells of Owsley, a picturesque inn, as most upriver inns are, and a place where a very good glass of ale may be drunk, so Harris says, and on a matter of this kind you can take Harris's word. Old Windsor is a famous spot in its way. Edward the Confessor had a palace there, and here the great Earl Godwin was proved guilty by the justice of that age of having encompassed the death of the king's brother. Earl Godwin broke a piece of bread and held it in his hand. "If I am guilty," said the earl, "may this bread choke me when I eat it." Then he put the bread in his mouth and swallowed it, and it choked him, and he died. After you pass Old Windsor, the river is somewhat uninteresting and does not become itself again until you are nearing Bulvaney. George and I towed up past the Home Park, which stretches along the right bank from Albert to Victoria Bridge, and as we were passing Datchet, George asked me if I remembered our first trip up the river and when we landed at Datchet at 10 o'clock at night and wanted to go to bed. I answered that I did remember it. It will be some time before I forget it. It was the Saturday before the August bank holiday. We were tired and hungry. We same three, and when we got to Datchet, we took out the hamper, the two bags, the rugs and coats and such like things, and started off to look for diggings. We passed a very pretty little hotel with clematis and creeper over the porch. But there was no honeysuckle about it, and for some reason or other, I had got in my mind fixed on some honeysuckle, and I said, "Oh, don't let's go in there. Let's go on a bit further and see if there isn't one with honeysuckle over it." So we went on till we came to another hotel. That was a very nice hotel, too, and it had honeysuckle on it, round at the side. But Harris did not like the look of the man who was leaning against the front door. He said he didn't look a nice man at all, and he wore ugly boots. So we went on further. We went a goodish way without coming across any more hotels, and then we met a man and asked him to direct us to a few. He said, "Why, you're coming away from them. You must turn right around and go back, and then you will come to the Stag." We said, "Oh, we had been there and didn't like the honeysuckle over it." "Well, then," he said, "there's the manor house just opposite. Have you tried that?" Harris replied that we did not like to go there either because we didn't like the looks of the man who was stopping there, and Harris did not like the color of his hair, didn't like his boots either. "Well, I don't know what you'll do, I'm sure," said our informant, "because there are only two inns in the place." "No other inns?" exclaimed Harris. "None," replied the man. "What on earth are we to do?" cried Harris. Then George spoke up. He said Harris and I could get a hotel built for us if we liked, and have some people made to put in. For his part, he was going back to the Stag. The greatest minds never realize their ideals in any other matter, and Harris and I sighed over the hollowness of all earthly desires and followed George. We took our traps into the Stag and laid them down in the hall. The landlord came up and said, "Good evening, gentlemen." "Oh, good evening," said George. "We want 3 beds, please." "Very sorry, sir," said the landlord, "but I'm afraid we can't manage it." "Oh, well, never mind," said George. 2 will do. 2 of us can sleep in 1 bed, can't we?" he continued, turning to Harris and me. Harris said, "Oh, yes, he thought George and I could sleep in 1 bed very easily." "Very sorry, sir," again repeated the landlord, "but we really haven't got a bed vacant in the whole house. In fact, we are putting 2 and even 3 gentlemen in 1 bed as it is." This staggered us for a bit. But Harris, who is an old traveler, rose to the occasion and, laughing cheerily, said, "Oh, well, we can't help it. We must rough it. You must give us a shakedown in the billiard room." "Very sorry, sir. 3 gentlemen sleeping on the billiard table already, and 2 in the coffee room. Can't possibly take you in tonight." We picked up our things and went over to the manor house. It was a pretty little place. I said I thought I should like it better than the other house, and Harris said, "Oh yes, it would be all right, and we needn't look at the man with the red hair. Besides, the poor fellow couldn't help having red hair." Harris spoke quietly and sensibly about it. The people at the manor house did not wait to hear us talk. The landlady met us on the doorstep with the greeting that we were the 14th party she had turned away within the last hour and a half. As for our meek suggestions of stables, billiard rooms, or coal cellars, she laughed them all to scorn. All those nooks had been snatched up long ago. Did she know of any place in the whole village where they could shelter us for the night? "Well, if you don't mind roughing it," she did not recommend it, mind, "but there was a little beer shop 1/2 mile down the road to Eaton." We waited to hear no more. We caught up the hamper and the bags and the coats and the rugs and parcels and ran. The distance seemed more like 1 mile than 1/2 mile, but we reached the place at last and rushed panting into the bar.
You have been listening to episode 10 of 3 Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 11 of 3 Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.
What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. All Father Thames keeps rolling along.